Good morning. It's Friday, the 26th of April, and this is Govindraj Ethiraj, broadcasting and streaming from Mumbai, India's financial capital. Our top stories and themes for the day: Indian markets may be hit by Wall Street blues. How many players does India's telecom sector really need? Kotak's technology fuel bets and a TCS announcement on AI. Inheritance tax, how practical is it? And why it's getting tougher to get away with misleading product claims?
This is a Core Report with Govindraj Ethiraj.
Indian markets could be hit by Wall Street blues. The stock markets gained for a fifth consecutive session on Thursday. The big winners were earnings-driven and included Axis Bank and Nestle India, and the State Bank of India hit a fresh all-time high and ended about 5% higher at 813 rupees. On the other hand, Kotak Mahindra Bank crashed after the Reserve Bank of India banned it from adding clients digitally, and more on that shortly. The Sensex seesawed yesterday, opening down, hitting a high, and then closing with a gain of about 486 points at 74,339. The BSE Sensex has rallied 1,849 points in the last five straight trading sessions. The Nifty 50, again yesterday, touched a high of 22,626 and finally settled 156 points higher at 22,559. Now, on Wall Street, and this is important because it could set the mood for today, was disappointed with an earnings report from Meta Platforms, that's the owner of Facebook. Shares of Facebook's parent were down as much as 19% after Meta forecast weaker than expected sales in the current quarter, even as it said it would spend more on areas like artificial intelligence. Macro data points in the United States were not very strong either. The Dow Jones was down about 600 points at open, and bonds fell as well. So, US GDP was weaker than expected for the January to March quarter, and prices rose at a faster pace, according to the Commerce Department on Thursday morning. US GDP increased at a 1.6% annualized pace when adjusted for seasonality and inflation, according to the department's Bureau of Economic Analysis. Now, the expectation was 2.4%. So, both growth and inflation are a continuing concern. And more tech results are on the way, including from Alphabet, Microsoft, and Amazon. And Wall Street, for all these reasons, is on the edge, a factor that could play into markets in India as well. How many telecom companies does India need? Well, it depends on who you ask, and of course, when. If you had posed this question in the 1990s, the answer could have been a handful, but just in one city. One of the many, for instance, was BPL Mobile, then run by now India's Minister for Skill Development, Electronics and Technology, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, who also calls himself, by the way, a cellular pioneer. Now, if you ask that same question today, the answer is a handful with a small difference. It's actually for the whole country. And if you ask Aditya Birla Group Chairman Kumar Birla, he would say that India deserves three private telecom companies. Now, the struggling Vodafone idea is obviously the third one. The Birla company and stock has been in the news because it has raised 18,000 crores through a follow-on public offer. Vodafone Idea's new shares were listed on the stock exchanges and were trading around 13 rupees a share. According to Kumar Birla, the group has stuck around for about 2.5 decades and has invested, along with the Vodafone group, almost 170,000 crores in the Indian telecom industry. So the interesting part of the Vodafone story is that the Birla group pretty much walked out of the company. 3 years ago, as Vodafone struggled and was on the verge of bankruptcy, Kumar Mangalam Birla quit the board and offered to give away the company to the government. As far as I can see, nothing like this, surely for a company of this size, has happened before in corporate India, or at least that I can remember. Birla's move, possibly born out of sheer desperation and fear that other cash-rich companies in the group would suffer, worked. He returned in April last year, or 2023, after a government rescue package which allowed telecom companies to pay their dues in equity, according to a Bloomberg report. So the government of India is now a 32% shareholder in Vodafone Idea, the only company to avail of the debt-to-equity conversion option, and its stake will now fall to about 23% after the fundraise. The history, as a Bloomberg piece by columnist Menka Doshi points out, is also a story that speaks of the policy risks of doing business in India, including license cancellations by the Supreme Court following corruption charges in 2012. And that period also saw several top telecom executives go to jail. The launch of Mukesh Ambani's Jio cut-price service in 2016 also hurt the profitability of the existing competitors, but also set off a data and smartphone boom of the likes that has perhaps not been seen anywhere else in the world. In 2018, Vodafone India and Idea Cellular, which was the original Aditya Birla Group telecom company, merged with each other. And thus, India's telecom industry was down to 2.5 players, as Sunil Mittal, founder of Bharti Airtel, the second largest company, described it, obviously in reference to Vodafone Idea. He had said at that time that India deserves to have at least three players, which brings us back to the three-company remark that Birla made yesterday. Of course, there is a fourth player, and that's the government, which is usually or should be an equal source of discomfort for all private players. So what perhaps both Mittal and Birla are saying is that they need more private players as well, also perhaps to balance out the government's BSNL or MTNL services. Kotak and a TCS announcement, technology's perverse effect. Two somewhat disparate events from yesterday. Kotak Bank stock crashed 11% after the Reserve Bank said the bank had to stop issuing new cards and also stop soliciting customers through online portals. The second aspect is a little more relevant to our discussion today. In the second instance, TCS CEO K. Krithivasan said that generative AI would replace many, or if not most, call center jobs in a year. And he was referring particularly to both India and Philippines. Now, this prediction made to the Financial Times of London is somewhat frightening, mostly to the people who work in the lower end of the business process outsourcing or the BPO companies, including, I'm assuming, some part of TCS. Now let's return to Kotak Bank. The Reserve Bank of India's action against Kotak Bank, asking it to stop onboarding new customers through its online and mobile banking channels, will hit the bank's near-term growth, analysts said on Thursday. And this is because Kotak Bank relies heavily on online channels for new retail customer acquisition. According to Motilal Oswal Financial Services, about 99% of new credit cards sold and 95% of new personal loans sold by volume were done digitally. As a result, the share of unsecured loans increased to about 12% in the third quarter of 23-24. In a circular, the Reserve Bank of India had said that the action was necessary as the bank had failed to plug gaps in its information technology systems. It also said that there were frequent outages in the bank's core banking system and online channels in the last 2 years, which inconvenienced customers. Kotak can, of course, continue to provide services to existing customers, including credit card owners. So the one word to note here is digital, which is obviously a subset of technology, or you could say it sits on top of it. So now the specific technology applications would differ even within the bank. For instance, between credit cards and bank account opening or disbursing loans, and then of course managing the daily transactions. All banks worldwide, however, use technology to leverage efficiency for customer interaction and of course growth, which is to bring in new customers or give them more products. Now, these are slightly different things. Firstly, internet banking has made our lives simpler. As our lives get simpler and the machine takes over the process, it's obvious that any business will use the machine or technology to grow faster. Now, think back to some years ago when sales agents would accost you outside airports, among other places, to get you to sign on a form and then get a credit card. Many credit card companies still solicit customers inside airports. Acquiring customers digitally, of course, is like a dreamlike scenario for banks, because it reduces friction considerably, though I'm not sure it's cheaper because the cost of digital acquisition can also be high. But you can scale at speeds that you could never do before. And you need to do more of that if you're a listed bank in a competitive space, particularly in areas like credit cards, which obviously have higher margins. By the way, when the front end is digital, you also need large call centers to manage the obvious customer interactions that will follow, which banks have either set up or outsourced. Now, to go back to the Financial Times report, which quotes the TCS CEO envisioning a future where call centers receiving incoming calls become rare and get replaced by proactive artificial intelligence systems capable of predicting and addressing customer issues before they arise. The TCS CEO believes that chatbots equipped with generative AI will be designed to analyze customer transaction histories and performance tasks traditionally handled by call center agents. Now, while acknowledging that this transformation might take some time to materialize fully, Krithivasan, according to that Financial Times report, expects significant progress within a year. How he will sell this to his own staff, particularly, like I said, those who perform the lower-end BPO work, is not clear to me, but that's a different story. TCS has apparently won more than 200 engagements in artificial intelligence so far, and the number of engagements going into production is also increasing. Now, let's return to banking. It's quite evident that in many cases of RBI crackdowns, technology or the dependence on it has played a role in systems breakdown. Let me give you one simple example. A core banking solution or the main technology solution of a bank, which sits on a bank of servers, can handle, let's say, 100 transactions a minute. As the number of transactions grow, the server or cloud space has to increase. If the infrastructure does not keep pace, the system will slow down or fail. Now, this does not happen very frequently because we would know, but there's clearly a reliance on technology to get things done and faster. Now, imagine a situation where, in the pursuit of efficiency and profits, banks go further and bring in more AI and generative AI on the front end to handle customer interactions or increase the automation. Now, some of this is actually happening already, and the mix is a little dangerous if you think about it. Technology, as we can see, has increased efficiency, but also the nature of frauds, including on digital payments or the peer-to-peer National Payments Corporation of India payment systems, or the stuff that you do via Bheem or GPay. As reliance on technology increases, the Know Your Customer or KYC quality will weaken by definition. Banks will then rely on artificial intelligence to, let's say, filter faster so as to catch likely problem accounts either at inception or during transactions. A few months ago, Axis Bank suspended my credit card because the system believed a dubious transaction had happened, and presumably it felt that it had to prevent further transactions from happening. Now, none of the people I spoke to subsequently could show me which transactions were dubious, and yet the system was convinced. I had to wait for several weeks for a new card to arrive. Another family member's account was blocked by Standard Chartered because the system saw some apparent anomalies in the high number of Google Pay transactions. There was obviously nothing wrong, or at least that the bank could convincingly explain or substantiate, but the system summarily froze the account, and it took several weeks to restore it, and obviously multiple calls and visits to fix it. So not only did the technology-led system freeze the accounts, but the humans seemed to have lost complete control, both in the case of the credit card and the bank account. And I'm sure many people, and some of you too, have faced similar problems. So the reliance on technology is fraught with mishaps like this. In many cases, you could be the victim. Remember, one reason the Reserve Bank of India cracked down on Kotak Bank is because customers faced problems repeatedly. Now, there is no solution out of this because obviously you need technology, and we all need technology, and we're used to it. Except to acknowledge that all efficiency comes at a price. And the price of efficiency will be an increasing number of breakdowns like this, some small, some large, some involving inconvenience, some sheer loss, and many of them quite indiscriminate and even senseless, as I found out recently. Inheritance tax, can it work in India and with Indians? So inheritance tax means that if you die, then your estate will be taxed by the government as it passes on to your inheritors. So the inheritors receive less than what existed in the first place. India had an inheritance tax. It was called estate duty when it was introduced in 1953 and abolished in 1985. India also had a wealth tax and a gift tax, which were abolished again in 2015 and 1998 respectively. So the idea of an inheritance tax is obviously linked to wealth accumulation and the issue of more egalitarian distribution of wealth, particularly as it passes from one generation to the other. So this issue right now is obviously a very political one, though it should concern rich people mostly and not everyone, as it seems to be the case, since the thresholds are pretty high. Be that as it may, I reached out to T.P. Oswal of T.P. Oswal & Associates, a firm specializing in direct and international tax, among others, and I began by asking him, particularly for those who have not been following this, to define inheritance tax in a historical context before asking him, more importantly, about the practicality of such a tax today.
Inheritance tax in India was known as estate duty, a duty levied on your estate after your death. At the time of death, whatever assets you have, and if the assets are passed on to your legal heir, those assets are getting transferred, and therefore estate duty was levied. The estate duty was introduced in India in 1953 by a socialist government, and this was abolished by their successors in 1985 after the death of Mrs. Gandhi when his son was prime minister. So therefore, there seems to be some logic. In 85 they abolished, in 1853 they introduced. Corollary of estate duty is generally gift tax. Wherever there is an estate duty, gift tax has to be there. Otherwise, people will transfer the assets to his relatives without paying any gift tax. So gift tax was introduced in 1957. So we had estate duty in 53 and gift tax in 1957. Gift tax was abolished very recently, 1990 or so. But estate duty was abolished immediately.
Before I come to India, what is the international experience very broadly in your own understanding at this point?
By and large, developing countries do have estate duty because they need taxes to pay social security. They need taxes to create development, roads, infrastructure. In our country, nothing is there. So therefore, you go on collecting taxes. It has no significant value addition to the person who is paying taxes. So therefore, people are reluctant, and that's why tax planning is created in such a manner that person dies, also does not pay estate duty. My experience is wealthy people don't pay estate duty. The tax was introduced for people, wealthy people dying at the time of death if they leave any estate to their successor, so the estate duty was leviable. However, they have planned their affairs in a manner there is no chance for levying estate duty unless there is a sudden or unexpected death of a person in an individual in an early age. And because of that, his lot of wealth, amassed wealth is transferred. Like in the case of some examples we can take, Singhania family, one of the managing director died in the early age. So estate duty was levied.
So you're saying that in some cases, estate duty or inheritance tax, as we, whichever way we call it, has been levied on different people in India in the past?
Estate duty, when it was introduced in India, this was one act where there is no changes made in the Estate Duty Act. All the case laws are in favor of the revenue, not in favor of the taxpayer. Introduction, because it was drafted by Britishers, and we have copied that. Initially, estate duty exemption available to every individual up to 15 lakhs of rupees. And then one house was exempted. But you'll also be surprised to know estate duty also claws back. If you have transferred any assets prior to your death within 2 years, then those assets are also deemed to be transferred on your death. And therefore, that was also subject to estate duty. For example, I die today. After death, I can't say I die today. Suppose I died today. But before dying, before 2 years, I have transferred my lot of wealth to my children. Nothing is left with me. Where is the question of estate duty? If I have died within 1 year and 364 days, then estate duty becomes levied. So such a draconian law. Now, estate duty rate of tax in India, you will be surprised to know, it was 85%. Can you imagine a person having amassed wealth, accumulated wealth at the time of death, his successor will get only 15% of them, which was absolutely unfair and unthinkable. And see, when I gave you example of 2 years clawback of the Indian Estate Duty Act, Britain has similar Estate Duty Act where 7 years prior to the death, estate transferred to anybody else by way of gifting, also is treated as deemed estate transferred, and the estate duty is leviable. So each country has its own regulation creating, and there's no uniformity.
And what would be the rate, in average rate, let's say across Europe, EU?
Around 40 to 45%.
And that would apply even in these kind of cases, the deemed transfer, which goes back 5 years.
Deemed is a part of the estate transferring on the death, and therefore it will be leviable. So there's an exception, Australia and Canada, they abolished Estate Duty Act. But then they brought in this estate duty indirectly under the Income Tax Act. They say it is a deemed disposition. And if it is a deemed disposition, then transfer takes place, capital gain is leviable. Both these countries have the law for levying capital gain on transfer disposition of assets at the time of death to legal heirs.
Right. So the other concept that's talked about, which of course appears a little far away now, is wealth tax. Now, wealth tax is obviously something that I'm assuming would apply when you're still alive and on the wealth you're generating. But inheritance tax, as we're talking about, only applies when you die or the person in question dies. So now let me come to the practicality of it. Given your understanding of how, let's say, the tax systems in India operate, including across other categories of tax, how practical is an inheritance tax in theory?
Very impractical. For example, why it was abolished. Take the reasons why it was abolished. Total tax collection from estate duty was 20 crore. And the expenditure on collection was more than 20 crore. Then you have to create officers, cadre. Throughout India, you have to depute, at least in major cities. And then that all the process, like income tax process, goes on. There is a mechanism of appeal. There is a mechanism of going to High Court, Supreme Court and Tribunal, all. So therefore, this was a more cumbersome job for department And collection, again, at times collection becomes a challenge because there are family disputes, and the family disputes are in the court. Court grants the stay. How can you recover the money? So therefore, estate duty was a challenging task, and people were using all the techniques of avoiding the payment and delaying tactics. And second thing, you can imagine one thing, how many wealthy people we are having in the country, how much tax we are collecting from wealthy people. Handful of the taxpayers collect pay the high tax. Government collect 99% of the tax from handful of the taxpayers. Rest 1% of the taxpayers are either below 10 lakhs of rupees or something below 2-7 lakhs of. There is some category of people who are within 10 lakh to 2 crore rupees. But majority of the people are below taxable or low tax, and therefore estate duty you are targeting to collect the estate duty from say 1,000 families. 1,000 is very exaggerated number. Maybe 50 families. So from 50 families, then do you think that the rich people will keep quiet? They already planned their affairs. Half of their estate is outside India. People with a view to avoid the estate duty, they become non-resident. If the non-resident is dying outside India or in India, but estate is outside India, the country concerned can levy the tax provided they have tax of estate duty. India can levy tax only on the estate in India, not beyond that. So people hold assets in India through a foreign company. That is not deemed to be transferred.
Right. So last question, TP, at least for today. You know, so estate could be in various forms. It could be obviously mostly immovable. It could be in the form of ownership of shares. It could be in the form of, let's say, commodities like gold. How does a tax official, even if they wanted to, and we had a law tomorrow, how would they actually move on assets like this, which are so distributed and of different types, some liquid, some not liquid?
First of all, matrimonial property law becomes relevant for the purpose of determining estate. Second is principle of succession applies. Third is criteria of living taxes should be defined. Fourth is evaluation. Each asset has to be valued separately and mechanism has to be provided. Approved valuer's requirement will come up. Then calculation of tax. Then concurrence with other taxes. Formality is required to be completed, which I told you earlier. There could be double taxation if you are a resident of two countries, both countries levy tax. For example, in USA, it is based on the citizenship or green card, whereas he can be resident in India and therefore both levy will tax. And there is hardly any mechanism for relieving double taxation. Only one country with whom we have signed tax treaty on estate duty is UK. India has not signed any tax treaty for relieving double taxation from estate duty. And then planning opportunities domestically as well as international opportunity. These are main points which I thought are relevant for the purpose of discussing the estate duty.
TP, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
It's getting tougher to get away with false product claims. Hindustan Unilever has rebranded its category formerly known as health food drinks to functional nutritional drinks or FND and removed the health label from Horlicks in light of the recent regulatory changes in the health drinks category. So if you've been consuming Horlicks or were consuming Horlicks decades ago or for decades, then obviously this comes a little late. Nevertheless, this change follows a directive from the Ministry of Commerce and Industry, which instructed e-commerce platforms to remove drinks and beverages from the healthy drinks category, according to a report in the Economic Times. Now, HUL said that the shift to a functional nutritional label offers a clearer and more transparent representation of the category. The problem is there is no precise definition for health drinks in the Food Safety and Standards Act 2006. The Food Safety and Standards Authority of India, or the FSSAI, recently asked e-commerce platforms to refrain from labeling dairy, cereal or malt-based beverages as health drinks or energy drinks, obviously to prevent consumer confusion and misleading advertising. So there are two kinds of issues. One is, of course, misrepresenting attributes of products, and the other is to do with the content of the product itself, as was the case with Nestle allegedly adding more sugar in infant food in India as compared to some other countries where the sugar levels were much lower. So one key issue that's emerged, including in the light of the recent Supreme Court observations in the case of Patanjali, who claimed a cure for COVID, is that there is far greater attention on claims made by brands and companies, which is good. So to what extent is this changing, and how should brands approach the new and increasingly enlightened consumer I put this question to Manisha Kapoor, CEO of the Advertising Standards Council of India, and I began by asking her about the Horlicks campaign and then went on to ask her about what brands should do at times like this.
You know, one of the things that we need to remember is that consumer information, their need for specificity is only increasing. And as they get more familiar with things that are health, or even we've seen in other categories like green claims, etc., I think it is now time for advertisers to move to more specific claims rather than general claims, because general claims have the effect of an overstatement. So, you know, if I have a healthy ingredient, should I call myself a health drink or should I call myself a drink with XYZ? On account of, I think, the consumers requiring and demanding this information, you know, questioning of what is being given to them and what they would like to consume, I think this move is in the right direction to not have generic claims, but to have very specific claims which are limited to the extent of the benefit that the product has. This we are seeing as a overall shift, and we will continue to see more of these in the future.
Your latest studies, category-wise, what are the main categories and what were the kinds of violations?
So we see a lot of violations in healthcare. That remains the number one sector, with close to about 18% of our complaints coming from, you know, the healthcare sector. And many of these are now on digital as the medium. There are a lot of violations of the Drugs and Magic Remedies Act. We now see a lot of categories like nutraceuticals, supplements, etc., which are very active on e-commerce, on social media. So we pick up a lot of violations there, which is again, you know, making health claims that are not substantiated or are in fact disallowed under the law. So, you know, a lot of them claiming things which are disallowed under the DMR Act, the Drugs and Magic Remedies Act. So cures for, you know, disease like cancer or diabetes and things like that. So in that nature, classical education is another big category for us. So is personal care. Betting is another big area that we are seeing huge numbers, and particularly the offshore betting kind of companies, followed by food and beverages. So these are the top four or five sectors that ASCII has been very active in chasing.
Right. So to come back to healthcare, now we've seen the Supreme Court make a lot of statements around the Patanjali case, which also has come to you in the past. Now, what the Supreme Court seems to be now saying is that, okay, it's not just Patanjali, but there are many others who are misrepresenting, maybe not in the same league or the same intensity, but they're misrepresenting. And that seems to include a pretty broad swath of consumer product companies. So how are you seeing your own activity levels and responses now going forward, now that all of this, going to your first point as well, has become a much bigger thing and now has become an issue which consumers are now more aware and focused on?
Yeah, so we definitely see this as, you know, an area that ASCII is already very actively working in. I mentioned to you, healthcare is the number one sector in terms of violation. So we already have a very strong Suo Moto cell. Also, just to let you know, Govind, about 80 to 90% of the ads that we process come from our own scrutiny and scanning. They do not come from consumer complaints. So we are scanning the environment constantly to pick up violations. And I mentioned to you, you know, the violations on account of the Drugs and Magic Remedies Act have really kind of shot up. Earlier, a lot of them used to be in very obscure newspapers and, you know, small local print. Now they are just all freely available on all the e-commerce platforms. So that definitely is a big area of focus for us. You know, it continues to be an area of focus. Food and beverages also, as I mentioned, is an area that we closely look at. You know, of course, there's a whole overlap now between health and food and beverages. So we definitely see our work only growing in these categories in the days to come.
Right. So if you look ahead now, so what would you advise brands, small or big, including, let's say, many of those brands who are direct to consumer, mostly on e-commerce platforms and so on, or for that matter, even large ones? I mean, what would you advise them? I mean, in this new era where there is far more scrutiny, whether it's by the courts or on social media or by, let's say, activist consumers, how should brands be, particularly in the health space, since most of our attention is here now, how should brands be approaching their communication and messaging?
So I think the key thing is to claim what you can prove and what you can substantiate. I mean, I would say that is really the principle. And claim only as much as you can substantiate. Don't generalize more than you can, you know, actually prove when called upon to produce evidence. And I think the second thing is that what is the consumer's interpretation of the terms that you use versus there being technical terms? I'll give you an example. A while ago, there was a brand that said that X number of their products gave the same energy as a glass of milk. When they were called upon to prove it, what emerged was that in terms of calorie value, it was the same, and therefore energy is measured in calories. So from a technical point of view, they could say that, let's say, biscuits are equal to milk in terms of energy. But the consumer understanding of the word energy is not calorie. It is in terms of, you know, how much energy I have to do something, you know, how active I am, etc. So it is also trying to understand the consumer interpretation of the terms that you're using. And I think to the point that we spoke earlier about both health claims or green claims, etc., they need to now be more specific, because when you say my product is green, the consumer will think of it as having a positive impact overall, whereas you may have only a very small component of it which is working in terms of that claim. So I think claim, like I said, just as much as you can actually do it, and be careful of the terms and terminologies that you're using to describe your products.
And I mean, everyone knows that you are there, as in the council is watching, and still obviously many advertisements seem to be playing fast and loose, to put it mildly. So my question is really, are advertisers not putting in the requisite effort? Of course, going forward, they may have no choice but to put in more effort. Or are they just not being maybe alert enough or aware enough, you know, not bothering enough to really ensure that there is sufficient evidence to back up their claims?
Well, I would say it's a bit of both. I think there are players who may not necessarily intend to mislead consumers, but end up using terms or terminology, and that may just be because they may not necessarily have the experience or the expertise to craft that. Having said that, that is not an excuse to mislead consumers. But the thing is that at least when you bring it to their attention, they are willing to change and they're willing to learn. And then there is a set of advertisers who may be repeat offenders or are willful offenders, where things are brought to their notice and will still continue to flout both the ASCII guidelines, which are in a sense reflective of many of the laws. So they are also flouting potentially a few laws of the country. And I think for willful or repeat offenders, you know, the law really has to step in. Self-regulation, by its very nature, requires the self in the regulation, and it requires a voluntary effort by organizations to comply and to be within certain guardrails. But when that is not something that an organization believes in, then the law and the court need to step in. So regulation and self-regulation really need to work in complementary ways. Asking, you know, for the cases we pick up, we receive over 90% voluntary compliance. So that's great. But for the rest of the 5 or 10% of people where voluntary compliance does not work, the law must come in, you know, examine the case on its own merits and implement the provisions of the law.
Right. Manisha, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks, Govind.
That was the Core Report with me, Govind Raj Ethiraj. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter for our exclusive stories, one in-depth feature a day on www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback on how we can make business more interesting and relevant, including, of course, India's vibrant manufacturing sector. So write to us at feedback@thecore.in. And thank you once again for listening.